This is Spectator Radio. If you'd like to subscribe to The Spectator, you can get 12 issues for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming. When we booked this room, we thought we're taking a bit of a gamble. This is one of the biggest venues you can get in London, short of the Albert Hall. Tempted that we were with Albert Hall, we thought we'd shoot for this one first. And it's quite a historic building. The UN General Assembly first sat here. Joseph's Technicolor Dreamcoat was first performed here. The speakers we've had, not the Spectator, but previously have spoken here. You've had Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Winston Churchill, all of whom are fitting warm-up acts for tonight's events. So it is incredible at a time where, you know, people question how much interest there is in serious political debate that we can sell out all 2,000 tickets in the Westminster Central Hall tonight. So thank you so much for coming. And please welcome Douglas Murray and Lionel Shriver. Sorry. Let's try that last bit again. They actually are out there. Please welcome Douglas Murray and Lionel Shriver.
Thank you. Hello. 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 Hello.
Well, good evening.
Hi, nice to be here.
Would you like to kick off?
I will kick off. We've been scheming. As you know, we're both here to talk about identity politics. If you know anything about our work, you know we're here to talk about what's wrong with it.
Or leave now.
Yeah. In fact, we theorized that these tickets just cost just enough that our detractors won't pay for a seat. We're going to organize the evening in this manner. We'll talk a few minutes about the general phenomenon, what it is, and why we don't like it. And then we thought we'd follow the organizational structure of Douglas's new book, which is looking at four categories of gays, women, race, and trans. And then we're going to spend a few minutes at the end wrapping up what we both think we should do about this, what's the solution. And that's going to be the shortest part of the evening because we really have no idea. The rest of the evening, of course, is going to be up to you. Half an hour, 35 minutes before we go home, it's up to you to come up with some questions, and something about this subject matter suggests to me that we're not going to run out of them. Briefly, my problem with identity politics, which I would define as a single-minded obsession with viewing everything in life, in all of human history, through the prism of the rivalry and power relationships between groups. My problem with that is that it's flattening. It's an ugly, dismal way of looking at being alive. And it's an ugly way of thinking of both the self and of other people. Those are related. We all have selves. But according to identity politics, the only thing that matters about anyone here is your race, your gender, whether or not you're disabled, what your sexual preference are, and whether you're satisfied with your gender. In fact, identity politics has fractured so much that these categories of people who are implicitly pitted against each other for your sympathy are infinitely subdividing. And that's the second problem with this way of looking at the world, is that it's fundamentally adversarial. And so it pits us all against each other. And ironically, it pits us all against each other in the weirdest of spectrums, which is who's more oppressed, who has it the hardest. It's not about becoming powerful. It is about it's about seeing your powerlessness as your power. And that kind of inversion weirdly means that people who regard themselves as oppressed have no reason to get unoppressed, that is, to solve their problem, because their problem is their ticket, their gravy train. That's where all your power is. Weakness is power. Disadvantage is advantage. And so that we are encouraging people to embrace their own fragility and their own difficulties as the source of their very identity.
I don't disagree with any of this.
I don't imagine we're going to disagree on anything.
We're going to have to find something. What Lionel describes, I noticed in recent years, as beginning with the phenomenon of speaking as A. Maybe it'll even happen in Q&A later. Well, shot in the foot if you do that. But speaking as A is one of the ways in which you start to sense this movement. Speaking as a woman, speaking as, nobody of course says speaking as a man, but speaking as a gay or speaking as a person of color and so on and so forth, is the start of this movement, which I think has been weaponized, politicized to an incredibly dangerous degree in recent years. I describe it in The Madness of Crowds as being like, in the last 15 years in particular, like seeing a set of rights claims, women's rights, equal rights for people, whatever their sexual orientation, equal rights for everyone, whatever their origins, as looking like seeing a train coming into a station that it was meant to arrive in at. And just as it looked like it was arriving in at the desired destination, suddenly getting ahead of steam, going shooting off down the tracks, off the tracks, and then scattering people in its wake. Why, I started to wonder, when the situation of all rights claims had never been better, were all of them presented as if they've never been worse? Why should everything have taken on this retributive manner?
Well, the worst thing that can happen to any liberation movement is getting what it wants.
Yes, yes. Well, they become like the phenomenon we see in charities. This happens in the charitable sector. You set up a charity to deal with a particular disease. If they cure the disease, or the disease has a cure found for it, the charity always finds a way to continue. It will become the charity for people who once had that disease or knew someone who had it. And because by this point, pensions were involved and careers and much more. So we see the thing now there was a time, needless to say, when, for instance, gay rights groups, civil rights groups in America and so on had a point. Now, what is the point of these entities, other than to claim that they've never been so oppressed, that it's never been worse, that everything's about to get much worse than we know, and then this strange weaponization of everybody against everyone else, so that the gays are used against the straights, and the women against the men.
And the trans. The
trans against everyone.
Yes.
I mean, just total war. And people of different racial backgrounds against each other, so that we now see, and we'll get on to this, but we now see the epithet white and all of these derivations.
Which
of
is
that.
Pejorative.
Solely pejorative. So I suggested to Lionel one of the ways we might approach this tonight, as she says, is to follow the way I do it in The Madness of Crowds, but to invite each other to tread onto all of these landmines one by one. I say there that what I want to do, and I should just say one of the fortunate things about being a writer, and perhaps I should also say particularly for being a writer for The Spectator, is that you can say what you think without repercussion. And increasingly in our society, that isn't the case. We see extraordinary situations, people losing their jobs for stating very basic truths that everyone agreed until 48 hours ago. Weird cases, like an Asda worker sacked for sharing a Billy Connolly video. So my view is that writers have a disproportionate duty, therefore, in such a situation, to tell the truths that a lot of other people are increasingly unable to say. And the analogy I use, as some of you may know, is an analogy of a device I discovered that the British Army uses, that it pulls, it's called the Great Viper, and you pull it on the back of a truck to the edge of a minefield, and then you fire this huge missile, and it goes over a minefield with this long explosive tail, and as it lands over the whole thing, then it detonates in one go. The analogy came to mind because this can't clear all the mines, but it can make it safer for people to cross the field, which is, I would submit, one of the points of people like Lionel and me doing what we do, is to try to speak and say the things that we need to be thinking about.
Although, not to denigrate either of our excellence, one of the reasons we're here is that a lot of other people aren't. Mm. That is, I will speak especially for my colleagues who are fiction writers. Mm-hmm. They have gone along with this movement to an alarming degree, and I find myself really out in the cold in relation to all this material. And while I have gone ahead and merrily written whatever I feel like for The Spectator, and good for Fraser for publishing it, I sometimes wonder whether that's because I'm brave or that's because I'm stupid. This is a very dangerous movement, and it has become predatory. Mm. And I have a couple of times now come within its sights, and I've got away with my skin, if it went up another notch, I could easily see publishers leery of putting my work out.
What's the nearest you've come?
Oh, well, of course, there's a contest between the two. One of them was more UK-centered, and one of them was international. The international one was when I poked fun of cultural appropriation and in Brisbane, Australia, and it was the first time that a conversation had got going on this topic, and everyone went bananas. But it was more the UK one that I think struck the fear of God into my UK publishers, and that was when I wrote about the Penguin Random House plan to make both their authors list and their staff perfectly reflective of the UK population in relation to gender, class, race, ethnicity, sexual preference, and disability. I'm sure I've left some out, And this was such an absurd project when it, ostensibly, you know, their job is to sell books, not to reflect the UK population. So I made fun of it. And but since it did have to do with diversity, you know, you don't make jokes in the area of diversity. That's what really got me into trouble. The column was funny. Death. And so they took one line in particular out of context, and it went crazy on social media. It helped that there was a firewall up on The Spectator so that they couldn't read the whole column. Not knowing what you're talking about is a big assist for these people. And you know, I was widely decried as a racist, and my father, the civil rights activist, would be surprised. Perhaps a bit disappointed. And ever since then, I mean, I'm sure you've suffered the same thing. you know, eventually these insults start it's water off a duck's back, you know.
Sure.
You know, tell me, oh, right, you know, I was a literary white supremacist.
Yes. Trying to smuggle white supremacy back through the medium of the novel.
Right.
Yeah. It's a long game, that one.
Damn, so far it hasn't worked.
There's a restaurant in Portland, Oregon that was open for about a fortnight. It was called Saffron Colonial, and it was shut down because it was accused, because it had the term colonial in the title, of trying to bring back colonialism. And I say it about that, well, again, it seems like an unlikely way to start colonialism. The long march via Portland restaurants.
Now, if we want to talk about gays, I have one question for you. I'm curious, to what degree do you rely on being gay yourself in order to have standing to talk about some of these subjects? Do you find yourself using it in an almost manipulative manner?
Gosh. I'm going to get you for that one.
And he thought this was going to be friendly.
Yeah, yeah. It might be for anyone else to judge, but where I'm sitting, here's what I think. I actually start The Madness of Crowds with the gay chapter for a number of reasons. One is there's something systematic that's important about it, which is that I think that on each of the litmus test issues of our time, all of the real difficult issues of our time, they all fall into one of two categories. Either they're things that we pretend we know lots about, which we don't know much about, or they're things we all know about or knew about till yesterday, which we've forgotten. So gay and trans, we pretend to know a lot about, and in fact, they're pretty mysterious things still. Relations between the sexes, clearly, because we're all here, aren't a total mystery. We knew about them for quite a long time and now pretend not to know or pretend to have instilled a new set of ethics in it. So for a systematic reason, I thought it was important to stress this by doing gay first. But you're right to put your finger on this issue because, to some extent, yes, I wanted to say, look, if I'm willing to pull apart, look at, and stress the difficulty of gay, and this is the one issue which I have my crampons on the edifice of social
as
justice.
As a gay man, comma.
Right. Then I wanted to say, look, if I'm willing to explore the difficult things we still don't know about gays, for instance, then trust me that I'm not being insincere in doing the same thing on other issues like relations between
That's
sex.
That's what I was getting at, that you were establishing standing. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I use the word manipulative in a manipulative manner. But ultimately, you use what you've got.
Yeah. My view is, as I say, as a way to show that if I critique this, or indeed, a couple of gay friends have said to me, I don't think you should have said some of the things you said in that chapter, because, for instance, I talk about this thing of hardware, software. One of the few ethics that we've agreed on in our society is don't go for people for hardware issues. So, you know, one of the reasons, among others, which we agree that, you know, you wouldn't be rude to somebody who's disabled, among much else, is it's not like they chose to be disabled. That's a hardware thing. There's nothing they could do about that. One of the things that's interesting in the ethics we've been creating in the West has been in recent years that because of this, a lot of issues are auditioning to be seen as hardware issues. So gays auditioned very clearly, campaigned to say, look, it's because people said born, because people said lifestyle choice. The obvious play to lifestyle choice is, well, it's obviously not a lifestyle choice because who would choose to make their life a bit harder? Was to say, no, born this way, the Lady Gaga option. And the problem with the born this way thing is it's a sensible tactical play, but it's not quite true because we still don't quite know. But everything wants to be hardware because it's then harder to critique. Trans at the moment is presenting itself as hardware because if it's hardware, who would...
Proof of hardware.
Oh, no proof of hardware. And here, of course, we'll get on to this, but here's the really difficult one is that trans says we're hardware at the same time as saying being a woman is software. You can have one of those programs, but not both. You can't say the only people legitimately born the way they are trans people. But yes, several people said to me, I don't think you should have opened up this whole born this way thing with gays. Mm. But I wanted to show, look, it doesn't affect my sense of self. If tomorrow a gay gene was discovered, or tomorrow they said this is purely a nurture thing, it wouldn't affect anything in my sense of myself, because I haven't built my sense of myself or identity on the fact that I happen to be gay. But yes, have I ever used it? No, I think not, because I've never been given an inch of privilege by my critics for this fact. No one on the left ever, the Guardian has never said, come on, give Douglas a break, he's gay. Or at least, if they have, then I wasn't reading it that day, so.
Well, I was struck by something you said a few sentences ago, that you don't center your identity around being gay. Hmm. And I think that's one of the things that's important about the gay movement. It's one of its great successes, is that in the early days, when you met someone who was gay, that was enough. That was who they were. Hmm. That was an identity. And it's kind of thin, you know, as something to cling to. That
it's not a full-time job.
It would be a pretty exhausting full-time job. And frankly, for straight people, at least, it became a little trying. Mm. And I think for gay people, it became a little trying, because all gay people are not the same, and they don't all necessarily have a lot in common.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the way identity politics encourages you to think, that these are all homogeneous groups, and they all have the same interests, and they're all politically the same. You get that in your book. And they're not all politically the same. They're just not all the same. And these group memberships don't give you much. They're a starting point, and if you are a true individual, they're often a starting point that you may form yourself in opposition to. They are the parts of your life that you don't have control over. And especially if you accept that gay is hardware, then that's yet one more thing you were born into. Mm. And I am in opposition to this whole movement, because these categories don't satisfy my sense of identity. Mm. I don't cling to being white or female or American or able-bodied or any of all the categories I was born into was something that I wanted to break free of or be larger than.
Yes.
One of the pleasures of my life, for example, has been leaving the United States, making my home here. I'm still American. I've never lived it down. But I made my world larger. And, you know, in some ways, getting married to a man made my world larger. Hmm. You know, I care about both sexes. Hmm. Having friends who are of another race, it makes my world larger. Mm. Why would we want to cling to our own little cages?
Or stay in your lane, which is one of the phrases that's used about this. You've got to stay in your lane. Like, don't veer away from the group you're in.
Right.
Don't talk about groups you're not in. You know, if you're a man, you have no right to talk about women, because why would men be interested in women? And don't talk about people of a country that you're not from. I mean, but just to put that bit back on you, because if somebody said, oh, Lionel, you're my favorite female novelist.
Oh, it's an insult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Profound insult, because it then says, right, I see you first and foremost as a woman. But have you ever had that used against you? Or used it?
I mean, de facto, publishing divides into female writers who are implicitly writing for women and male writers who are writing for everyone. So it's mostly done it's mostly expressed through packaging and publicity. And I hate that category. I may take a little too much satisfaction in men who read my books, but it is a big relief when I discover that there is a male readership for my fiction. Hmm. And I admire men who cross the gender divide and are willing to read female writers, because they pretty much don't.
Hmm. What? Just to get onto this, as you know, the women chapter in my book, I'm mainly interested in this thing of why women are being weaponized against men, and specifically why we've been falling into telling a set of things we must know to be untrue, or holding an untrue set of positions, so that I have this suggestion that simultaneously at the moment in our culture, we hold several views. We say women and men are exactly the same, and women are magically better on occasion. The Christine Lagarde-ism, if it had been layman sisters, she keeps saying, then the crash mightn't have happened. They say, but why? I mean, it's a fascinating thing to try to unpack. Why is it that they're better? Are they more cautious? If so, where would you deploy the cautious women? But it's not that. It's simultaneously just exactly the same and sometimes better.
Well, of course, I have always clung to the solution to this constant argument about whether there are big differences or whether we're the same by not even needing scientific evidence, but looking around me and verifying that the variations within the sexes are so much more drastic than the variations on average between the sexes, then I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. Mm. I mean, it's, in fact, there's an interesting, there was an interesting piece in Quillette recently. I hope you saw it. And it had two bell curves set side by side. And one of them was the qualities that are associated with femininity and how female women are. There was that bell curve. And then there was how male men are. And there was that bell curve. Well, the intersection was huge, and the tails of both of them went into the far range of the other. And if you can, I don't know whether I'm getting this picture across right, but the point is that there are very masculine women who are far more masculine than men, and there are very feminine men who are far more feminine than women. And this is without getting surgery. And I think the whole part of the whole trans movement is responding to this complexity. I love complexity. I'm a novelist. I think, and I think it makes life more interesting, and it makes our relationships more complex. And furthermore, I'm not entirely happy with the whole idea of male and female characteristics. There may be a rough accuracy to them. I'm not going to fight it. But I don't think of myself as especially soft and passive.
I'm not going to dispute that. But one of the things we seem to be struggling over is how do you form a society in which nobody should be held back if they've got a competence in a particular area, irrespective of their sex or sexual orientation or race or anything else? How do you make sure that nobody is held back without doing things like mandatory quotas? Because occasionally in recent months, people have said to me, you know, a lot of this identity politics stuff that you go on about is, it's a kind of university graduate problem. It's a Berkeley University problem. It's a West Coast liberal arts thing. And I've started to realize that the only people who say that to me are people who are self-employed or retired. Because almost everybody in the world of work notices now that this is coming for them, that recruiting processes, in search of making sure nobody is held back if they've got a competency because of an identity issue, are moving to, let's put the identity issue first and foremost, and then go on to the competency if we like.
Well, I mean, that's why I got in so much trouble for that column about Penguin Random House.
Yeah.
The United States has been dealing what we call with affirmative action, or positive discrimination, if you will, for 50 years, and it hasn't worked out very well.
Yeah.
So this is one of those rare instances where I come in as an American and tell you what to do. Don't make the same mistake. Mm. The UK has traditionally been resistant to solving problems of inequality between groups by artificially manhandling those groups into quota systems. But along with identity politics has come the sudden popularity of this kind of privileging, if you mm-hmm. to use a favorite word of the movement, privileging what you are over who you are and how good you are at whatever you're supposed to be hired to do. And same thing in education. It's a disaster. And it's a disaster for the very people you want to help as well as everyone else. And I think this is one of the things that so-called social justice warriors don't wrestle with. They don't understand how complicated social justice really is.
Yeah.
After all, the reason that that we have law books this big is because social justice is really complicated and hard to work out. So that it just to come along and simplistically decide of, blacks have been discriminated against, so we're just going to hire a bunch more blacks and we're going to publish all their books and and we're going to put all these black people into universities and then everything will be fine. Well, that's just not the way it works. I mean, and it's unfair on a couple of levels. It's unfair to the people whom you displace, who may be better qualified, mm-hmm. and they didn't create the inequality, mm-hmm. right? They just were born into it as everyone else.
Yeah.
And it's also unfair to the very people you're trying to help because, look, they're not stupid. If you have a quota system, so that's why they were hired. That's why they got into this school. That doesn't make you feel good. Mm. That doesn't create personal esteem. And furthermore, there's a larger contamination of the assumptions in the whole society, which has really permeated the United States now. Frankly, you meet a black lawyer and you figure he got into school because he was black.
Yeah.
And that is evil.
Yeah.
You know, that is perpetuating racism.
Yeah.
That's what it does.
Yes.
So don't do it.
Yeah, Charles. Charles Murray, no relation, mentioned this recently in an interview. He said that when he was at Harvard in the 70s, if he saw a black student, he thought, wow, you must be smart. I mean, you must be really smart to be here. You know, you have worked harder and everything else to get here. And he said he couldn't help thinking that this generation of students would be looking at such a person and say, somehow gerrymandered.
Yeah.
And all the follow-on thoughts that causes. And we've seen recently the phenomenon of Harvard and the admissions scandal precisely on this. And if any of you have not followed this, I'll just say, I mean, this is an example of one of the ugliest things of our time, that you open up. And this is one of the reasons why I'm urging people not to play the identity politics game, because we don't entirely know what we unearth when we start this. Harvard thought that it was going to improve admissions for, among others, African Americans. And what's been uncovered in the last couple of years, because a group of Asian students have taken Harvard to the courts, it's called, what's the name of the group? Anyhow, they've come together to take out a lawsuit against Harvard, because what they discovered was that Harvard University was, in order to try to be more racially fair, was downgrading Asian applicants to Harvard. And what turned out in the discovery process was that they were doing so before even interviewing Asian students, and they were downgrading them. And by the way, Harvard fought like anything to try to stop this coming out. They said that this was their tricks of the trade. This was their, you know, their secrets. Well, yeah, it was. And the secret was that they were downgrading Asian applicants before meeting them on character traits.
Yes, they would get characterized as passive or lacking in leadership quality. Unimaginative.
Yeah.
Interestingly, it did play to the cliche of what Asians are like, because
it was an entirely racist set.
It was incredibly racist. But, you know, it wasn't even racist. I mean, in other words, it was purely manipulative. It was purely in order to get their scores down, because the Asians were coming in with these near-perfect SAT scores, the college admission test. And, you know, the truth is, they worked too hard. And if you look at what's happened in California, which has banned by referendum using race in admissions, meaning that people really are getting in on the basis of their test scores and their ability, the Asians have basically taken over the state's university system.
Yeah.
And by the way, more power to them. I think it's fantastic. You know, if they're going to work that hard and apply themselves that much and make that many sacrifices when other teenagers are out, you know, catting around and having fun, then they should be rewarded. And but one of the most interesting things about the Asian story in general, it's not just in education. They're doing fantastically well in the United States and also here. Is it really spanners the whole reasoning of affirmative action?
Yeah.
Because you cannot argue, especially in the United States, that Asians have not been discriminated against. I mean, we passed something called the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 1880s, specifically keeping Asian people out. And there was terrible discrimination against them. And grotesque stereotypes. And interestingly, you know, fast forward to today, we've got some of the similar problems with hostility and stereotypes, although this time because, you know, the Chinese are taking over the world. So that's why Americans remain often quite hostile to Asians. But if you have this identity group that has been historically discriminated against, and often their parents are poor and immigrants, shouldn't they be doing really badly with unless you give them special help? They've got not only are they not getting special help, but they're being actively discriminated against because their test scores are too good.
So it
ruins the whole model.
Yeah, in the Great Depression Olympics, it doesn't help. It's like in America, we have the whole reparations debate now. It's an incredibly painful debate. But I've often said to American friends, if you start going down this road of looking at who historically has been prejudiced against, and by the way, history wasn't great for anyone by and large, you know. But if you start playing that game, you could end up having to agree that among the most oppressed people in history, perhaps the most oppressed, were the Jews. And would you want to go house to house and collect money from everyone to give it to the Jews? You might spark a new type of problem were you to insist upon that in certain communities. But it's the sort of thing we start to open up. And by the way, I wanted to now ask you about this. To a great extent, the racial issues, which are now coming back and weaponized, seem to me to be, to a great extent, a spillover from American racial issues. And it's very striking to me, the sort of globalization of a specific American racial issue. And, I mean, there's an example, I think I gave it in my last book, when Black Lives Matter came to London a few years ago, and whatever the rights and wrongs of that movement in the U.S., it was surreal to see Black Lives Matter, about 1,000 or 2,000 people marching. I went to the protest, marching down Oxford Street with their hands in the air doing the Black Lives Matter thing of hands up, don't shoot, all escorted by unarmed British police officers who couldn't have shot them if they'd wanted to, you know. And I just thought, well, whatever the rights and wrongs of this in America, why would you be doing this here?
Yeah.
But that's endless issues in the race thing seem to be like that.
Well, the UK does have an unfortunate tendency to imitate.
Yeah.
And of course, that imitation is fired by social media. A lot of what we're talking about today is now Western-wide. I mean, it's true of the British diaspora also.
You know, all the
whole
world.
Commonwealth, Canada, Ireland, and Australia also have really rabid, hard left identity politics movements in them. So, and they're, you know, all these people are in communication with each other and the internet, and so in some ways we can't talk about polities as separate anymore. The contamination has really accelerated. But I have to say that, you know, one of the problems with this whole movement is that it's regressive.
Yeah.
And I feel it's really ramming us into reverse. You use that image of a train going forward and off the tracks, but in some ways it's screeching to a halt and running backwards.
Mm.
Because a lot of the issues that we're talking we've made great strides on, and now I feel like I'm in a time machine.
Yeah.
You know, so that even on the gender front with women, I feel as if we have fought this battle over and over again. After all, we keep calling it a different wave, but it's a wave that's crashing in place. We keep having the same argument over and over again, and meanwhile things get better. With race, it's somehow even more poisonous. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed, you know, we have made considerable strides with racial discrimination in the United States. Yet at the same time, if you look at the newspapers, you'd think that it was worse than it's ever been.
Yeah. And indeed, the polls show that most Americans think that it is worse.
Especially
now.
White liberals.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they've documented that in 2010, 25% of American white liberals believed that race and racial discrimination was a huge problem for the country.
Mm.
6 years later, it was 58% among the same people. So something weird has happened. And what's especially weird is that American liberals are more upset about race relations in the United States than blacks and Hispanics are. And they think it's worse.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that's where we get down to one of the core qualities of this movement. I mean, it sounds as if it's all these different separate groups clamoring to be heard and clamoring for their rights. And there's an element of that. But overwhelmingly, the group that's really at each other's throats is white people, white liberals.
Yeah.
White liberals are behind this movement, not, you know, discriminated against black people or whatever. It is liberals competing with each other who can be more righteous.
Mm.
And, you know, oddly, oddly, the people who are most woke and who use the term privileged in that pejorative sense, which means you have to shut the fuck up, they are overwhelmingly white, affluent, and well-educated. In other words, they are the privileged.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's the privileged who are telling other white people to shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
And the irony of this, you know, self-selected elite is that they're getting down on everyone else for being privileged, But what they really want is more privilege for themselves.
Yeah.
It is a kind of greed, because on top of having all the money and the great education and all the status, that's not enough for them. Mm. They have to have the moral high ground.
Yeah. This is one of the explanations for the phenomenon of so-called woke capitalism. I suggested after the crash of 2008, actually corporate America and corporate Britain found it rather easy to start playing this game, because it was a way to show that you were paying indulgences to the religion of your time without actually having to take account for mistakes you'd made. So you would say, yeah, of course, we'll make sure the diversity officer does a bit more of this, and we get the, as I've discovered, it's an alarming number of corporations, we'll get the intersectional stuff going, because it'll show that we're playing the game of the time. By the way, I mean, one of the other things about this, which is worth mentioning for a moment, is that this keeps happening in each of these areas, so that some people work out what the game is and play it very well. Mm. The ones I'm worried about are particularly young people who, it's already hard enough to work out what the game of life is. And then there's this extra layer of complexity needlessly put on the top of it. I give the example in relations between the sexes of the analogy from Nature of the cuttlefish, which I've become rather interested in. A biologist friend introduced me to the cuttlefish, because a particular type of cuttlefish has an extraordinary thing. It's like a mimic octopus. It has a way of changing its form in order to adapt to the environment it's in. Now, specifically, there's a bad female-to-male ratio in the cuttlefish community, and they work as consorts, so a male will accompany a female, and will make sure that the female isn't accessed, shall we say, by competitors. This makes it hard for the male cuttlefish, and the important thing to bear in mind here is that the males are larger than the females. So what happens? The male cuttlefish has developed a way to look like a female. It makes itself smaller, more diminutive, and it sidles up whilst the male cuttlefish is thinking, okay, there's no competition, gets under the female cuttlefish, and then has its wicked cuttlefish way. And when I was told this by this biologist friend, I just said, oh my God, I've seen this so much. And I was specifically reminded of my friend and colleague at The Spectator, Freddie Gray, who covered the Women's March in Washington just after the inauguration of President Trump. And he told me, I think he wrote about this in The Spectator, that he'd followed the whole day. He gets back to an after party, and he's in a sort of dorm-like party with some women who'd been on the protest, with various men. They were sort of the Ivy League equivalent of the sort of people who go, yeah, that was like such a totally brilliant march. And so they were doing that. And he described to me how they were all wearing their pink hats and everything. And whilst the women were there, the guys were all doing that. Yeah, yeah, fuck Trump. And the moment the last woman left the group, one of the guys went to the others, oh my God, I can't believe how much action there is in this room. Okay. He used, actually, I should say, a slightly ruder term, which I won't use for Spectator audience. But the moment that Freddie told me about it, I thought, yeah, of course, this is pure cuttlefishing behavior. You pretend that you go along with the whole thing. You feminize yourself a bit. You present yourself as a sort of harmless little man, and then you can get in and get the action. Well, the problem is a lot of young men haven't worked that out. And the ones who have are disproportionately privileged, actually, as you say, privileged, rich, well-educated, and have sussed the game of the era and are playing it so damn well. This seems to me, among other things, incredibly unfair on a lot of people. But we should, by the way, we haven't got any shortage of things to talk about, but we should get on to my favorite issue.
I want to ask you one question
before
we move on to trans, because if we don't, this audience will riot. But while we were back on women, you've generally been identified with the intellectual dark web. It's just a loose confederation of people who do a lot of events and podcasts together. and they're not insane. I think that's a good...
Very kind of you.
I want to know why you think there are almost no women in that movement.
Such an interesting point. Firstly, it's a very loosely described group,
yes.
As you say. Secondly, there are some. The brilliant Christina Hoff Sommers, for instance, has been...
Then there's Christina Hoff Sommers, and as I recall, there's also Christina Hoff Sommers. I mean, it's astonishing. I admit that when the writing's not going very well, I do sometimes go to YouTube, and it is remarkably consistent. Now, I should say, before you get all defensive, that in a funny way, I admire it, because you, insofar as there you have any coherence as a group, and you're not confederated or incorporated. Yeah. You are not responding to any perceived pressure to 50-50 or to have more women. You have resisted any tokenism. And I like that, you know? I appreciate that. So I'd like a fuller explanation of why you think that this is somehow ends up being a very male pushback movement. Is it because women don't push back enough?
I think there might be two things. The first might be an agreeability issue, a character traits issue, could be, a disagreeability issue. A second, and I think this is worth mentioning, is, and we hear this in politics, we don't hear it enough in this direction, but let me do this by mentioning the trans thing in this. I mentioned in the trans chapter in this book what I think is the most reasonable, humane way of trying to understand something we haven't been talking about or thinking about at all well. But here's the thing. I've said a lot of things and written a lot of things about the trans thing, which I've expected a lot of pushback on. And I've got a bit, but again, it's water off a duck's back. But here's the thing that's very interesting to me. The people who are most angry about the trans thing when you say things that we know to be true about it, the pushback is extraordinarily strong against women. And I think this reveals something interesting about that movement in particular. The trans movement keeps, it's dominated by male to female trans, and I've been pretty much left alone with what I've said about this. And I just...
That surprises me. But then I told you, I predicted in my review of your book that the only people who would buy it were the people who already agreed with it.
It's possible. I'm hoping it's not the case.
Although I believe that's a lot of people.
Yeah. I want the people who don't think they can agree with me on this to take this one as seriously as possible, because if not, we are in the midst of doing something which future generations are going to look back on and say, they did what? Like, there's a 7-year-old boy in Texas at the moment, as you know. Parents are arguing about what gender the child is. The mother wants to transition the child from male to female because he liked Disney's Frozen at the age of 5. And the father says, no, I have a son. And they're fighting for this. They're fighting for this. And this is the sort of thing that future generations will look back on and say, they did what in 2019? In the name of kindness, of course. Because we always look back on history and think, well, they must have done stuff because they were evil. No. Again and again, people did the things that were worst whilst thinking they were being kind. So this issue is so live, and we need to think about it. But I am so struck that time and again, and I list the extraordinary women who've held their ground on this one, time and again, the target of the most virulent trans activists are women. Mm. Now, there is so much in this that you can unpack, but... It happened a few weeks ago in Manchester, where a group of women's rights activists have a meeting, and male-to-female transsexuals are banging on the windows whilst the police are standing around allowing it, whilst these women are being intimidated in the building. Now, what is this? Well, several things. One is, and let's be frank about this, one is deep disgust, hatred, and envy of people born women. Definitely going on. And a double hatred and a pursuit.
And it's interesting that disgust and envy go together. That's counterintuitive.
Sure. And this has been Julie Bindle, who I mentioned in the book, a female lesbian activist who's been campaigning for women in prison and much more for decades. Can't go anywhere without a trans protest against her. Julie Burchill, when she writes about trans, I mean, Julie says this is one of the things that she thinks sent her career down the kazi. Jermaine Greer gets it on that. Of course, Jermaine Greer isn't a feminist anymore. And on the list of the main people they have gone for and targeted are women. And I think that that just must end up having an effect. And I just enormously admire the women still willing to make the case because, you know, one of the things that's so interesting about the intersectional era and the intersectional claims is that they are demonstrably untrue on their own estimation of themselves. So the idea of this horrible-sounding movement of the intersectionalists is that the whole of our society is a set of interlocking oppressions. And if you unlock one of these oppressions, you unlock all of them. It takes no account of the fact that lots of these alleged oppressions run completely against each other. So, for instance, you say that the slightly effeminate boy is actually a girl. Or you say that the tomboy girl, who might grow up to be a lesbian or might grow up to be heterosexual, 80% of people diagnosed with gender dysphoria turn out not to have gender dysphoria. But you do this, and you are running straight against some very fundamental things of the women's liberation and women's rights movement of recent decades. You are running very fundamentally against the gay rights and gay liberation movement of recent decades, and this is only just being realized. So what I say to the intersectionalists is, even on the basis of your own claim about society works, you are creating a car crash.
What's extraordinary... What I find most extraordinary about the transgender movement, which really only got going in about 2012, would you say? Its extraordinary rapidity. It was a rapidity with which it not only took over socially and culturally, but even institutionally and governmentally, so that it was suddenly in our schools.
Yeah.
And you are asking five-year-olds which gender they want to be. But the other thing that's extraordinary about it is along with this rush of, you know, media obsession, you know, you turn on the TV, five different transgender documentaries on at once. What came in at the same time was what we all understood. You can't talk about it. You can't talk about it. You can't say a discouraging word about it. And even if you were very suspicious of it and worried that people were making rash and irrevocable decisions that they might regret, you knew you had to keep your mouth shut. And I think that's one of the things that Douglas and I are trying to break through. I think that's one of the reasons it was important for you to include that chapter. We have to be able to talk about it, especially now that we are mutilating and putting on drugs whose effects we have no idea. Our children. And if it didn't involve children, I think the urgency would be somewhat less. But this obsession, this trend, it's really become a kind of fetish. Is potentially doing a lot of harm to people who aren't old enough to know what they're doing.
I couldn't agree more. We should come to the audience for questions. I suggest, by the way, we save our what to do about it till the end of Q&A.
Sure.
But I just mentioned one other thing in the meantime, if I may, which is, I think the trans one is particularly interesting because it reveals something about this whole movement. I say about this that it's very striking when a movement is trying to gain following or acceptance. It's very interesting how it makes its moves. And the trans movement did something fascinating, which I think hasn't been identified enough. If you wanted to make a rights claim in this area, you would make the rights claim for intersex, that is, people born with indeterminate genitalia, because it's a hardware issue, and it's not a great way to start your life. It's a very suboptimal situation to be in.
I reckon it's real. You can see it. It's real.
And I reckon you could get a very legitimate, reasonable, and indeed pretty broad consensus of people to agree that these people need more help and understanding about them. Here's the interesting thing. Trans jumped all the way over intersex, never bothered with doing intersex, went all the way to, say, the big bearded man with a penis is a weightlifting champion in the women's bit, or you're a bigot. And it's an appalling way to try to build a coalition. So what I realized when looking into this was something I think is rather significant. They're not trying to build a coalition. They're not trying to do that. They are using trans as a battering ram. The same thing they've been trying to use women for, same thing they've been trying to use the gays for, same thing they're trying to use different races for. What is the battering ram? I would suggest it's something like this. And by the way, in some people this is, I say this in the Marxism chapter, in some people this is completely straightforward. It is post-Cold War, smuggling Marxism in through a new way, undermine everything about this society. Say that being gay is merely the first step to undermining capitalism. Saying that being a woman cannot be addressed unless we also bring down the free market. Say that we live in the most sexist society, the most racist society, the most unfair society. Do all of these things. Say that we don't know what men and women are. Undermine every single basis of truth that we understand. Demoralize everyone long enough that then they don't resist when you come in with your fully prepared Marxist plan. Now, some of that... In some people, that is completely clear, and I give examples of the people who said that absolutely explicitly at the end of the Cold War. We need to use minority groups to do what the working class ended up not doing for us. But other people are simply being misled that this is a reasonable...
I have to side with the misled. That's a neat theory, but the way you keep talking about they, I don't know who you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's ostensibly in control here. I can see how you can parse the way it works out as benefiting a kind of Marxist ideology, or it being a kind of retread of Marxist ideology. But that's different from saying that there's some authority or cabal of people controlling it. I don't agree with that. I think misguided is the name of the day. In fact, I think it's important at some point in this event to say that most of the people who have got caught up in this way of thinking, they're not malign.
Sure.
And they're responding to a natural human need for purpose, for meaning, and even for justice. I am not going to discount the real desire of a lot of people who feel passionately about these things for justice. I think their version of justice is simplistic and potentially unjust. But that's not to say that their motivation is wicked in any way. And therefore, I think they're misguided. And it's, I think, one of the best things that you observed in your book was it had a tenderness to it, that kind of understanding for what the movement is feeding, these kind of appetites. So that what's wrong with it is that it's something of a dead end. It's spiritually unnutritious in that flattening of the world, and it's a waste of their time.
Yeah.
And when you get a little older, you realize how precious that is.
Yeah. We should come to the audience. Quiet. Now, I can't remember how the system of questions works, but we're not responsible for it, either Lionel or I. And I think I just follow this. The lady, the number one over there. Okay, there's somebody there. Yep. And if I could just say the usual housekeeping thing at spectator events is, please you keep a question to a sentence with a question mark at the end.
Thank you very much. So just touching on historical comparisons, I was just wondering if you think we can draw historical comparisons to what we're seeing and indeed if we can draw comfort from that, have we not seen this before? For example, the example that comes to mind is the counterculture around the Vietnam War, a very febrile time in politics, but can we not draw comfort from the fact that that movement did fade away, and maybe this movement will fade away as well? Thank you.
Should we take two at one time? Maybe do number two as well.
Let's do them one at a time. I told
you. Okay.
Yes, I do take comfort that I have seen other movements come and go. And I am hopeful that we will look back on this period as particularly febrile and that something ran out of control. Hmm. If we don't look back on this period as particularly febrile, that's really bad news because it means that later it got even worse. I think the one thing that grounded the movements in the 60s and early 70s was, as you mentioned, the Vietnam War. And that was something substantive that really mattered to people who went off and fought it and didn't believe in it and damaged a lot of people and damaged a lot of families. And it made it, you know, somehow more palpable, more real. There was something, it was about something more than just free love and sex. It grounded that whole time. And of course, it was also on the heels of the civil rights movement, which changed the world in a very good way. And now we're dealing with a weird kind of backlash residue of that same movement. Mm. But I'm with you, you know. I mean, we were going to talk about what there was to do about this. And honestly, to me, the most likely thing that knocks identity politics out, because I believe it to be the result of prosperity. It's a first world problem. It's people not having enough to do with themselves. What's going to knock it out is something really fucking awful happening.
Yeah.
I wish I could come up with something else, but that's often what knocks movements off, is either something good comes along, not very often, but something awful happens and you have to concern yourself with other problems, and I suspect that's what's going to happen with us.
My question is, do you think the Democrat Party in this United States and the Labour Party in this country have embraced identity politics as a way of maintaining control on the minority vote?
Yes.
Yes. Number three. No, we'll flesh that out. We'll flesh that out. We'll take the gentleman's hat. Are you on?
Yeah. A second question is about emotions and feelings, because it looks like they're very selective of the audience. So when it comes to terror victims, they invite only the ones on the show to say love, not hate. Hmm. And then how they use the feelings to then manipulate people. So let's say doing a risk assessment for the workplace, death threat by email, then talking about trigger warnings, about words, and so on and so forth. Would you address that?
I mean, I would just, together, that the striking thing that's going on in politics at the moment, among other things, yes, the left-wing parties have, broadly speaking, latched on to this, because it's what they hope, as I say, the groups that didn't turn up in the Cold War for them, or let them down, this provides something very useful with. If any of you saw the LGBT town hall that the Democrats Party had the other week, it's something to behold. Don't watch the whole thing, but watch
it. It was nauseating.
It's unbelievable. It's actually an asylum outbreak. It's beyond anything you've seen. And it ignores the fact that, frankly, on some of these issues, we are dealing with very unwell people, literally grabbing the mic. Yes, and I think this whole thing, the whole thing of rhetoric in this, it's this weird thing that's come in Britain again in recent weeks, which we all know. No, and we mustn't mention the B word, probably, but it's this extraordinary thing where it works one way round, but not the other. You know, so there's basically nothing you can't say about the Prime Minister or Dominic Cummings, but one mean thing about one Labour backbencher, and it's, you know. Um, Do you want to, I'm just trying to get as many people in as possible. So, we went to go upstairs. Yeah, okay. Well, number five. We should be number four, mate.
Is it on? Yeah. The question regards to Douglas and your latest two books, if I could sort of compare them. To me, The Strange Death of Europe, through telling the story of immigration, you touch on the importance of two types of moral groups in terms of being a source of our identity. I'd say a national group and a religious group as a source of identity. And then in this book, it's the sort of amoral or immoral sources of identity from a group through race, gender, and sexual orientation. So just my question is, what sort of distinctions do you make between a moral source of a group identity and an immoral or amoral source of group identity?
That's a very intelligent, brilliant question. I mean, I would say it's this. Yes, there are only a few things you can do identity from. You can do it from religious affiliation. You can do it with national affiliation. You can do it with group identity affiliation. One of the reasons I criticize it is because, as Lionel has already said, I mean, it's enormously reductive and it's pretty shallow. One of the advantages, I'm not a nationalist or anything, but I think that the nation is its virtue is, among other things, apart from, as Roger Scruton says, the largest extension of the first-person plural that you can do, the we. Apart from that, also, the largest extension you can claim some kind of pride in, that you do actually have some involvement in. It's also the nation, among other things, is not bad. Of course, it can go wrong, like everything. The nation isn't a bad source of meaning also because it forces you to engage with people who you may not otherwise have anything in common with. And the identity groupings do exactly the opposite of that. They say you only have things in common with the one group that you are a part of, and it's a sexual orientation, racial, or other group. And I simply think that this is, among other things, an incredibly shallow way to do it, which also inevitably will weaponize. We know how nations can be weaponized against each other. We're pretty familiar with that. We're not very good at recognizing how identity groups of this kind can be used against each other. And I just urge people, particularly young people, not to play this game or to get out of this game as fast as they can and to get their lives onto something which will give them real meaning, because they can't find it here. They're being invited to play a game that's unwinnable and is profoundly wasting of their lives. And let me just make one other point in that. One of the things that troubles me so much about this is that we keep skipping over issues of meaning in pursuit of this. So, for instance, and I say this in the chapter on women, feminism, as Camille Paglia and many other people have said, never dealt with the issue of motherhood properly. Didn't know what to do with it. And it parked it. It's a hell of a thing to park. And that's the problem. There are all of these things we could do with thinking about better. And we're wasting our energies and we're wasting our time.
I would add that I don't recognize the categories of moral and immoral identity groups. I think more in terms of groups over which we can exercise volition or not. And the problem with fastening on to identities like race and gender are that we didn't choose them. And there's only so much will we can exercise over them. Whereas one of the nice things about nation is that we can exercise some volition over it, what a country is, what our country is, what it stands for, and what it means to us. And I'm more interested in the aspects of identity and of self that we can change and mold.
Yes.
Because I think of self not as a static thing. I mean, the whole idea of self that we're now raised with is you're already pre-made, and the project is to recognize what you are already. And that is not my experience of being a person. My experience, I don't want to go to new age on you, but it's a continual act of becoming, of creation, and I mean, if nothing else, you continually have to adapt to being another day older, and it's different. So, and that's a much more dynamic idea of what it means to be a human being. Mm-hmm. And to focus instead on the things that are never going to change from the day you're born is like locking yourself in a room.
Yeah, boxed in.
Yeah.
And then we'll come there, and then we'll come down again.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Fascinating discussion again, thank you. It seems to me, more than ever now, listening to you this evening, listening to you, you know, running through this whole sort of panoply we have now of negative ideologies, it seems to me that the most sort of virulent advocate for some of these things is actually our own national broadcaster. It's the BBC. Well, you've kind of answered. You've answered the first part of my question, which was, to what extent do people in the room agree with that? But I suppose just on a general level, what interests me is how have we got to a position where our institutions seem so rudderless and that we as the public seem so blasé that they can advocate ideology and pass it off as fact with so little resistance?
Yeah. Yes, and I would just add one colour to that, which is the BBC, like everybody else, is caught in the headlights of this enormously... something I maintain still is driven by a small number of zealots with a larger number of followers who are persuaded that they're doing the right thing. But the BBC and others are caught in the headlights on this. Almost all institutions are. I can't stress it enough. Large corporations, governments, commitments to diversity, all of this stuff, this is all flooding across the whole thing. And that's why you get spectacles like the last night of the proms this year. And, I mean, this was beyond parody. The first piece is a piece actually called Woke. commissioned from a young, talented, black British composer who writes the piece in The Guardian a couple of days beforehand saying, you know, I have been able to draw on three different cultures because my father's Egyptian, my mother's Ghanaian, and also this. And he said, and three cultures is better than one. And he said, well, that should mean your piece is three times better than anyone else's. And I don't know if it is, but the point is you just knew the BBC was just absolutely thrilled to be able to say, we've got a black composer commission. The thing is, again, it's understandable they get there. Who wouldn't want if the guy's terrific, and he was pretty good, but... We know what's going on. They're just like the soprano who sings at the end of it. I don't know if you saw this. There's a Canadian soprano who wore the colors of the flag of bisexualism, which I didn't know. They didn't know they had a flag. there's no mountain I've ever seen it on. And it's not been flown before, as far as I know, but it was flown by her. And then at the end of Rule Britannia, she gets out the LGBT rainbow flag and starts waving it during Rule Britannia. And you just go, just give us a break. You know... I don't know anyone who thinks that the world of classical music is this sort of unbelievably heterosexually dominated, you know, just sort of purges all the gays, you know. And just give us a day off, you know. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to ask you about disenfranchisement. I come from a part of the country that's traditionally more left than right. And as a few people have said this evening, this is obviously a problem that disproportionately affects left-wing parties, which leaves a whole lot of people like me disenfranchised, completely disillusioned. Do you think that enough people will end up like that to cause a political shift, so a sort of electoral result, like the Brexit Party, for instance? Or can it withstand, as you suggest in your book, due to its Marxist underpinnings? And the second question is, what do people like me, sensible left-wingers, do in the meantime?
Mm-hmm. what this movement is doing to the left in a broader sense is cooking its goose. They've run away with the Democratic Party, and, you know, we'll see what happens with impeachment, but if that doesn't work, Donald Trump could win this election because the Democrats sold out to its lunatic fringe. And so it's having a really deadly effect on the left. And one of the peculiar things about the dynamics of the movement are that their biggest enemies are not right-wingers, not real white supremacists, who are, by the way, are very proud of being white supremacists. Mm. That's how you can tell. It's classical liberals. They're the people that identity politics, that crowd go for. People like you. And there is some kind of psychological element at work. People tend to be most hostile to people who are ideologically most proximate. The far left has no big bone to pick with a bunch of racists or, you know, real alt-right types. Mm. It's no fun. You call them racist and it doesn't hurt their feelings.
Mm. Yeah.
Whereas when you call classical liberals racist, they start to cry.
Yeah.
So that's really fun. And that's the real problem is on the left within the left.
Yeah.
And the hard left is at the classical left's throat. Yeah. And the danger is that you just take each other down. And what's left? The right. Hmm. So politically, this is naff.
I entirely endorse that statement. I just add one other thing, which I maybe you say, what can you do? Answer that in a very broad sense, if I may. Don't agree to lies. Don't agree to things that you think are untrue. It's incredibly demoralizing. It's incredibly demoralizing to an individual, and it is to a society, when you have to agree to things you know not to be true. And whatever it is, in however small a way in our lives, just don't go along with it if you can help it. And just stick to the idea of having the right, which we still do have, to say what we think is true. We've got time very briefly. We'll go number six, and then here, and then maybe there. Number six isn't ready. What?
I'm very ready.
You're ready?
Douglas, you suggested that self-employed may be lucky enough not to have to worry about all of this. So if I may be permitted to use the phrase, speaking as a self-employed man... Sadly, it's not true. So I find myself increasingly having to fill in all kinds of diversity questionnaires in order to win work. And I just wanted a piece of advice from either of you. I recently filled out a questionnaire on my gender, which featured 12 possibilities, plus none of the above, which certainly begged the question. And I just wondered... Is it a cop-out to answer, I refuse to ask the question or prefer not to answer when there isn't a box marked, this is all bollocks?
I think you can write that in. The only time I've ever had to fill out such a form, I break a confidence in during the coalition government, the Conservatives tried to persuade me to take up a public appointment, which I was very loath to do, but they kept trying to push me. I won't go into the details. It was rather ugly affair. It's the only time I've ever filled out such a form. Of course, it's sexual orientation. That was quite a choice. I filled out that one accurately, and on all of the others I said, I'd rather not say. There was a rather not say box, and I thought that the air of mystery...
Yeah, I figure the prefer not to say box really terrifies them.
Yeah, mine isn't here. we said we'd go there. And then we sort of cut.
A few years ago there was there was a ban on the tube. There used to be an announcement, ladies and gentlemen, and a small group of trans activists decided to get this banned. Similarly, recently, perhaps even more ludicrously, Always, who is a manufacturer of tampons, has got rid of the feminine symbol on them because apparently men like me can also menstruate. But the point is that the reaction to this was overwhelmingly negative. When this was reported, it was all angry faces on Metro's Facebook page and all the other newspapers were reporting on. People didn't like this. And so how do we get round this, I suppose, this fallacy of numbers in a sense that a small, tiny group of people can affect a change even though the vast majority don't necessarily want it?
I this definitely is in the area of what Douglas was talking about, is you just cannot put up with lies. And, I mean, somehow we have to individually and collectively refuse to go along with this utter bullshit. I mean, apparently you can't say pregnant woman anymore. You have to say pregnant person, because men can get pregnant too.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but we've just gone off into la-la land. And even staying silent in the face of this stuff is to cooperate with la-la land, is to live there whether you like it or not. And, you know, for us to have entered a universe where we no longer believe there is such a thing as man and woman, and that the whole idea of sex is something we made up, it's a social construct, and that your sex is in your mind, and it's assigned at birth as if it were some kind of arbitrary eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Yeah,
by a bigoted maternity ward.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, we called it a boy last time.
Yeah.
This is social insanity. And I don't think we have to cooperate with it. I don't.
We've got time maybe for one or two questions, then we need to wrap up, I think, because I'm... Yes, lady there.
So I get your point, Lionel, about kind of white liberal virtue signaling and, well-meaning people being misled, but it seems at an underlying level there is something a bit more sinister. Like, it does feel like there is a deep disdain for, like, Western culture and Western civilization at large. And I wonder, you know, where the roots of that are, or if you agree that there's something more sinister going on.
I'm not sure I'd use the word sinister. Destructive. I come from an American liberal tradition, and there is a strain of that tradition that has always had contempt for the United States. So I'm very familiar with this. And it seems at first as if that's a form of self-hatred, so that, you know, yeah, that's maybe spiritually disturbed. But you know what? It isn't self-hatred. They don't hate themselves. They love themselves. They hate other people. They think they're better than other people. It's a kind of showing off. And American liberals who have contempt for the United States and profess to feel better than the United States and ashamed of the United States, they're not actually experiencing shame. In fact, a lot of white liberal guilt is not really guilt at all. They don't feel bad. They feel proud of themselves. Do you know what real shame feels like? It's terrible. You don't want to leave the house. Shame is crippling. These people are delighted with themselves. And it's, you know, it's wearing a t-shirt and or perhaps instead a designer hair shirt, yeah. Right? So one of the things that bothers me about this kind of faux self-hatred is that it's anything but what it pretends to be. It's lying, it's hypocritical, and it's pretending to be looking into the West's very soul and worrying about all the evil that has been conducted in our name. But that's not really what's going on. It's just a big game of one-upsmanship. Yeah. And quite frankly, in the way that it's being used, it is an insult to the real, often wicked history of places like the United States and even the UK. Yeah. You're being used.
We're going to have a final question there. Now, what I suggest is that with this one, we said we'd do a little bit of solutions. We've got about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Let's wrap our solutions into this excellent final question.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for the talk. It's an honor to be here. I grew up in a country very different to Britain, namely Russia. And I can tell you from my personal experience that this problem, the very notion of identity politics, is not present in other societies. It's simply non-existent. So other countries, other societies focus on scientific research, defense, undermining Western societies, while we here in Britain keep wasting time, taking this a bit further than we should. We keep creating more divisions, we keep limiting our own freedoms, and you argue that only some horrible, awful things can stop this. My question is, if we keep doing this, if we keep creating more and more chaos in our own society, in the long run, can Britain and the West in general fall behind other societies? And can that lead to horrible things? Thank you.
You didn't let us down. Lionel.
Oh, I do think that in some ways it's an indulgence. Most of it, aside from being seriously destructive socially, if nothing else, achieves nothing. It sets people against each other. It's very inward-looking. You know, it is interesting that even the modern form of feminism, which has attached itself to this larger movement, doesn't seem to give a toss about real discrimination against women in the Middle East and in parts of Africa. So it's myopic. It's myopic and self-involved. And again, it's this obsession with the small differences, with the proximate, right? So you don't look out to other countries and other places where they do things differently, and there are real problems. And I think this kind of self-absorption, and I'm afraid, though I have been up to my eyeballs in Brexit since it started, Brexit is having the same effect. It's nobody tells you, but actually, in the big picture, it doesn't matter that much whether the UK is in the EU or not. We're both going to be fine. And getting caught up into these what ultimately end up being quite petty disputes means that you're using all that energy in a kind of running in place, and you don't achieve anything else, and you abdicate other arenas, including international arenas, Russia, where you might be effective.
Yeah. Let me, we need to wrap up, but let me just answer that. I do think this is the case. I have a terrible vision that the intersectionalists will get something like what they want. Everyone will be in exactly the right lane, will have worked out exactly their position in the hierarchy that day, just in time for China to take over. And and that it would be a sort of cosmic joke that we, that as that happened, we were discussing gender fluidity or something. So here, as I suppose in wrapping up, here's why I want to help people to get out of this as fast as possible. I think there's a massive opportunity cost, to our society and to ourselves in this. I spoke yesterday to a very smart young guy at Oxford who interviewed me for his podcast, and I said something about one of the issues in this book, and he said, well, I'd have to look into the literature on that, and I said, just, sure, do, but don't do it too much. Like, do it a bit, but you should be doing something else with your time. And this is why I want people to understand this is an unwinnable game that they are being invited to play, because I think we need to get on to doing something else. What would that else be? Well, it's all sorts of things, but as a friend of mine was speaking at Harvard the other day, and he told me, he said, the Q&A afterwards was all about these issues. These are the luckiest people in the luckiest place, in the luckiest country, in the luckiest generation ever. Ever. And they were asking about these issues. And he'd said to them, he said, why are you doing this? You should be trying to work out how we live in underwater cities. You should be trying to work out how we live on Mars. You want to work out exactly where you are in the grievance hierarchy just in time to work out where you are in relation to your neighbor and then the new neighbor you have. You think this is a useful thing to do? And here is the problem on this. Everywhere I go in the world now, whichever country I'm in, I notice this. A smart person with access to the internet can be at exactly the right and same position anywhere in the world. Anywhere in the world. The furthest flung country you like, if they're smart and they've got access to the internet, they can get exactly to the same place that you can here in London, or in Washington, or somewhere else. And this is an unparalleled opportunity in human history. And we're squandering it. So my invitation is, let's get rid of this now. And let's move on to lives of meaning, and to doing meaningful things with our time. Because if we look back at this generation and we say, we achieved it, we nixed the whole identity thing, which cannot happen, that's not the greatest achievement we're capable of. And we're capable of more, and we should get on to it. We should say thank you to the audience. We are standing between you and your drinks. And so we shouldn't do this any longer, but perhaps we could just say on behalf of Lionel and I myself, thank you to you. It's just an enormous pleasure for us to be able to come out tonight to meet all of you and to have the opportunity to engage in this discussion. And we don't take it at all lightly that you've given up this evening to be with us and for us to be with you. So I'd just like to say thank you and have a good journey home.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Lionel. Thank you very much. That was terrific.